This podcast represents the opinions of Whiskey Wheels Wounds and guests to the show. The content here is for informational use only and should not be taken as medical advice. Consult your healthcare professional for medical questions. Views and opinions expressed are our own or guests and do not represent any organization we are a member of. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statement or opinion made. This podcast contains explicit language and mature content. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Whiskey, Wheels, and Wounds. I'm Sean Naber, 9-year United States Air Force vet.
And I am Steve Vickers, 22-year U.S. Army veteran.
I'm good.
I'm good.
Let's ride.
Okay, boys, time for the show.
Today's episode, Steve and I got a very special guest. His name is Andy Duke, 25-year retiree, Sergeant Major of the United States Army. He's one of our chapter brothers, rides a lot of miles with us. And we're just going to kind of get a hold of his story and talk about something that Steve and I have touched on before, and that's leadership and, you know, NCOs and good ones, bad ones, and hear about Andy's journey from a wet-nosed private all the way up to a Sergeant Major.
Hey, Duke, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
we'll just get into it. You've come full circle, right? You started out in Guernsey County in Ohio, come back, you live in Guernsey County now. What's the thought process? And I ask this, and I'll tell you why after, but what's the thought process of, was that always the goal to come home after serving?
Yes, it was. Growing up in the country out in Guernsey County, I grew up hunting, fishing, hanging out with my parents and grandparents who lived right next to each other. And my goal was to always come back to that property when I got out of the military. And I promised my grandfather when he was alive that I would do everything that I could to keep that land in our name for as long as I possibly could.
There it is. Yeah. And I was... I asked that because I was the opposite way. When I left Martins Ferry over on the Ohio River in 1993, I had no envisions of ever going back, you know. And as I've said on this podcast before, when I had to go back in 2017, it started the spiral of my mental breakdown, I guess, if you will. So that's why I asked it. I mean, we didn't have land. We didn't have 125 acres. We didn't have none of that. We had, you know, a corner lot, right? So, I mean, and so that was the difference. And that's why when I saw that, I wanted to ask that question. So you're back. So 1998, you enlisted?
88.
Or 88? Mm-hmm. Yeah, my bad. Yeah, 1988.
Yep.
Enlisted. You were air defense?
Correct.
Yeah.
Started with the Hawk missile system.
I'm not familiar. How long did that stay around?
Hawk missile transitioned out, I think, in the mid to late 90s into the Avenger missile system.
Oh, okay.
But it was a big transition because the Hawk missile system was a line unit was big, and the missiles were huge. So they're like 11 foot long, and they weigh like 2,200 pound a piece, and there's three per launcher.
What was the platform it was fired from?
It was a portable launcher base, so it looked like a box with a three arms on it that held these missiles, and it could slew 360 degrees.
Okay.
And it was pretty badass. When that missile left the launcher, it left at Mach 2.
Oh, that's getting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I only got to live fire those at White Sands. Right. You know, obviously, we'd never had any issues where we had to use them anywhere else.
Right.
But when Desert Shield and Desert Storm occurred— the Patriot missile was what was used to hit right. the Scuds. Uh-huh. They didn't use the Hawk, and that's kind of what caused the Hawk to fade.
Okay. And you know, now the Patriots have been deployed and sent to other countries, you know, Ukraine being the newest Patriot missile battery recipients, I guess. So, yeah, I get that. I'm familiar with the Q-36, 37 radar system that you...
We had our radar system. We had three different radars that we utilized. They had the pulsating acquisition radar, which is like what you see at the airports, the right. big thing. And then we had a continuous wave radar, which looked like a 55-gallon drum that had been cut in half and had a radar in the upper and lower portion of it.
Okay.
And then we had what they called the high-power radar, which was like a Mickey Mouse ear-looking radar. And that was the one that would shoot the RF beam to lock onto a target. So, you know, if an aircraft was coming in, you could lock onto something as small as a pop rivet on that aircraft, and it couldn't break it. So it was pretty awesome.
That was pretty neat, especially being in the, you know, 80s. And, like, that was, like, that's the type of technology that people could think of now, and the fact that it happened 30 years ago is pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, it's. And, you know, it was in that time. How long was the Hawk system around? I mean,
I think it was developed like in the 60s. Uh-oh. Raytheon developed it in the 60s. And I think we were going to use it, you know, for the Cold War.
Right.
But, you know, it never seen much action.
And so, and the Avenger system was similar.
It's much smaller. The Avenger system is just a Stinger missile, but it's mounted in a pod on a Humvee.
Right. The four.
Yep. And then it's got a 50 cal underneath the one side.
Yeah. It looked like those things that Arnold Schwarzenegger used in Commando. Them two square boxes he had. Yeah. Okay. I'm tracking.
Yeah.
I'm tracking the Avenger. Yeah. Cool. So was the goal to make SAR major? I mean, was that your...
My goal was just to make a career of the military.
Okay.
Making sergeant major was not something that I really aspired to until I made E7. Once I made E7, I thought, you know what? I've been here long enough. Right. I've done my time. I've taken care of soldiers. Now I want to be in a position where I can affect change.
Right.
Was what I thought. But you make sergeant major and it doesn't really matter. You
right,
still,
right.
You still have some officer that does what the hell they want to do anyway.
Right. Well, and you know, I was like my goal when I joined was, to be a first sergeant. That was my goal. That was, when I met, First Sergeant Hines in basic training, I'm like, I want to be that fucking guy. Right. I mean, it just, like drill sergeants are in your face and it, you know, they do their job. They make you feel like shit and all that stuff. But First Sergeant Hines was like different. And like when you see the drill sergeant's faces change when he walks in the room, you're like, the drill sergeants are like the baddest dudes in basic training. Mm. But when First Sergeant Hines walked in and their faces changed, you're like, there's something different about this guy. But you know, the whole drill sergeant thing never got to me. You know what I mean? Like it was never, you know, I never took it personal. You know, they called me meathead, which, you know,
I use that term now to describe an abundance of different things.
Right. But, you know, I was bigger than all my drill sergeants. So Drill Sergeant Johnson was 5'6", maybe. And he tried, you know what I mean? Like he tried to intimidate you. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't join for that.
Mm-hmm.
I knew joining that was part of the process, right? So I didn't need someone yelling at me telling me I'm fucked up. I've always been pretty good at doing a self-assessment, knowing exactly when I'm fucked up. And I had a football coach in high school, which, I mean, he beat himself up at halftime. I mean, punched himself in the fucking face at halftime. Yeah. So, nothing in basic training surprised me or, fucking, you know, scared me at all. But
see, that was me too. Dad gave me, Dad told me the goal when I went to basic was don't volunteer for shit. Stay in the middle of the formation. Your whole goal is to get through there and then not know who you are.
Yeah.
So at the end of basic, we had to go into our TI, you know, because Air Force, we do things a little bit different. We had to go into his office and you know, report and all that stuff. And I came into his office and stood in a position of attention. Then he put me at ease and he looks at me and he goes, "You're in my fucking flight?" I'm like, "Mission accomplished." Right. Mission fucking accomplished.
Yeah. I mean, but First Sergeant Hines, I mean, so that was my goal, through, most of, but then, you know, you get into the regular Army and you kind of put it on the back burner. You know what I mean? Like but I was always that guy that I did the right thing because it was the right thing to do type of thing. And, you know, I made the conscious, decision now that I'm in the military, all that knucklehead shit would, you know, go by the wayside. Except for when I was in Korea. I mean, but everybody acts like a fucking idiot in Korea. So
I think when you land in Korea, you know, especially like Dad was there in the early 80s, you get off the plane, you hand them your common sense,
right?
And they hand you a certificate like a you are authorized to be a fucking dumbass for the next year.
Right. And I think the worst thing, it was a double-edged sword. Like the worst thing and best thing that happened to me, my first duty station was Korea, right? So, you know, your leadership didn't go home. Your leadership was on the same camp as you were. You know, you drank beer with platoon sergeants and squad leaders and all that stuff. You know, my first sergeant Strickland wasn't First Sergeant Hines. And I'm like, huh.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, huh? Like this motherfucker's out here getting fucked up, right? Like, you know. And then First Sergeant Strickland, I mean, to his credit, I never came down on the blotter report my whole year in Korea, which is mission accomplished because I fucking tried. But First Sergeant Strickland, I was part of his safety brief. Like, hey, if you see Vickers downrange, keep an eye on him, you know? So
I think being in a situation like that, it helps you understand the lines between drinking beer the night before with the first sergeant and then the next day in formation, that's the first sergeant. It's not the guy I was drinking beer with last night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It helps you learn those lines. And I think it helps NCOs figure out those lines for when they get back.
Yeah.
You guys call it in garrison or whatever, right. But yeah.
Well, I was never, you know, I hung out like one of my good friends, in 93, 94 in Korea was my squad leader. That's not supposed to happen. Right. Like, at all. And then one of the biggest fucking shit stirs was the fucking corporal, right? At the time he was like 8 years time in service or whatever, a fucking corporal. And he was the most mischievous one of all of us. Like he was always getting us into some kind of shit. That ain't supposed to happen, you know? And So what I took from that is they were my friends, right? And again, Monday morning, if Sergeant Thompson told me to go fucking do something, I went and did it. But, I was never that squad leader. I was never that team leader. I was, you know what I mean? Like, never hung out, with Joe ever. Because come Monday morning, there will be no doubt who the fuck's in charge. Exactly. No doubt. So again, a double-edged sword, you know, when, you know, I used to tell Thompson, I'm the dumbass private. I can't be the voice of fucking reason here. You know what I mean? Like, you're supposed to tell me, hey, don't fucking do that, stupid. Not the other way around. You know what I mean? And more times than not, you know, I did a lot of stupid shit, but more times than not, it's me looking at Ferguson, Corporal Ferguson or Sergeant Thompson and be like, hey, bro, we can't do this dumb shit. You know what I mean? And so.
Well, you get some Joes that never grow up. You know, you got some people that don't have that in them to do what you were right. talking about. You know, some people are just fucking idiots their whole life, and they make it through the ranks that way.
Right.
And, you know, you get little Joes watching Big Joe, and they're like, is that the way I'm supposed to be doing
it? Yeah, and that's where fuck up, move up. That's where it derived from, right?
Yeah, they usually go to OCS.
Or right. But that's where it derives from. And, you know, I didn't ever want my guys to ever lose respect for me in that way. Now, granted, once I got back to the States, I was a homebody. I stayed at home with mama all day, and I didn't go out drinking and doing dumb shit. I ended up only doing dumb shit when I went to, you know, BNOC and ANOC and shit like that. So, which again, that's why it's called beer knock. And I mean, no matter your MOS, it's what it's called. And that's, but yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, again, I never wanted Joe to be like, he's a hypocrite. You know what I mean? Like, he's telling us not to, you know, don't fuck up on the weekends. And, you know, I used to tell my guys, if you need me, call me. If you don't need me, don't fucking call me.
Right.
You know, cause, I tell them, I don't want to be in your off life, but if you make me in your off life, I'm coming in with both feet. Like you don't, once you allow me into your off time, it's hard to get me out of your off time. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like if I have to come get you from a fucking police station or any of those shits, you know, it's hard to get me the fuck out of them now. So, good times, fucking good times in Korea. Shout out to Camp Castle, Korea.
So do you think from those two different perspectives? So I had a clear delineation between who I was when we weren't at the shop and who I was at the shop. And my guys understood that. And because I set that example, I didn't really have any issues. But I was also, you know, I was in my 20s, my early 20s as an E5. Most of my airmen were in their early 20s, especially being in Germany. You know, you're confined to the base. All the wives are, you know. So I was in their social off life, but they also understood that, you know, we may be hanging out tonight, but tomorrow morning, that's your ass if you fuck up. But I think that I always had the capacity to be a good NCO. I just needed to have it molded by good NCOs. So do you think that where I'm going with this is, do you think that everybody can be made into a good NCO, or do you think they're born with the intrinsic traits that just need to be molded? So do you make them? Sorry, you make an NCO regardless, but do you think you can make anybody an NCO, or do they need to be born to be an NCO? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I, my perspective is, I think they have to have those born. They have to be born with certain traits, you know, to be a good NCO. I mean, like I said before, anybody will make it up the ranks if you do your time and you get your points and all that shit. But there's a hard line difference between a good NCO, a good leader, and a shitbag that just made it through. And you can see it, like Steve was talking about before. You can look at somebody and you can tell if they're a shitbag or not.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's just character. You're either a good judge of character or you're not. And I've been blessed with being able to judge character pretty well. And 9 out of 10 times I'm right on the spot.
Yeah. I think you'll have the anomalies. You know what I mean? There'll be people out there that, you know, I got a buddy that if you looked at him when he was a young soldier, you're like, all right, when your enlistment's up, go ahead and drop fries at McDonald's. You know what I mean? And I'm sure he would tell you this. You know what I mean? Like, and he had a conflict with the leadership, and, you know, but then a switch. You know, like maybe his leadership qualities were dormant. You know what I mean? But you know, a switch went off, and he found his niche. He found, you know, let me go to Ranger school. Let me go to sapper school. Let me be a sapper instructor. You know what I mean? He found his niche, and which allowed him to progress through the ranks and make sergeant major. And, you know, and have a successful career. You know what I mean? And so I think it's one of those things where, you know, we all, again, we've all seen people where like, how in the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know what I mean? Like, I've seen, like, you know.
Who do you have naked pictures of with a goat?
Right. Like, right. Like, how in the fuck? But, you know, they. You have leaders that were book smart. You had leaders that could apply anything in the field. They could apply anything, you know. Then the army kind of morphed to wanting both. You know, like I was never the book smart guy. You know, yeah, I maxed out on correspondence courses, but who the fuck didn't, right? I mean, there's always, I was smart enough to figure out the ways around correspondence courses, right? So, I mean, those kind of things where, you know, back when, you know, military education kind of had more weight than civilian education.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I'm in the military, so everything I do to better myself will focus around the military. And you know, part of my problem in my career, I didn't evolve enough for the Army. I didn't evolve enough for myself. I was a pretty good. This is just me saying this. No one ever told me that, but I was a pretty good combat leader. And that's why, you know, going back to Iraq as many times as I did felt like home, and it felt like this is exactly why I joined the Army. This is exactly where I need to be. And this is exactly, me and my sweet spot. You know, this is my groove. And you had, that's where you separate leaders, right? In combat is where you sit. Like, you know, in 05, when I was in charge of my first patrol and, you know, 05, we had trip tickets, but we didn't have, designated routes. You know, it was me, E6, on the fly. Hey, we're going to, you know, we're going down here to the Gold Lady. We're going to turn right. We're going to go through the, you know, hit along the canal and up through the cemetery. And, you know, that's how we're going today. And everybody knew that, you know what I mean? And, but on the fly, you know, you come over the radio, it's like, hey, we're going to bang a right here. And then we bang a right. And there's days where you make that as a leader, you made that on the fly call. Hey, let's bang it right here. And an IED goes off. Right. So, you know, before that, it may have taken days or weeks or months or never to validate your order you've been given to your Joes, right? There it's instant. You made the call, turn right, shit went bad, right? Now, thankfully, no one died, no one got hurt, you know, this, that, and the other, but you made that, it was always up front in your mind, like every decision you make has a fucking consequence right now. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that pressure. I embraced.
Mm-hmm. You thrived.
Right. I embraced that pressure. Right. Like I felt that again, this was what I was meant to do.
In the late 90s and the early 2000s, you guys will laugh at this because, you know, the other branches see that as it all the time, but the Air Force was transitioning to what I call the whole person touchy-feely concept. They would rather you spend your duty day in college classes or volunteering downtown to be able to be promoted. And I was of the mindset, you know, very old school upbringing. My dad was, you know, Army early 80s. My grandfather was in for like shit through the late 40s and 50s and early 60s. You enlisted to do a mission. And that's what your whole focus was. Like, even my family life suffered because, you know, I wasn't issued my wife and kids. They took a backseat to the mission because that's what I raised my right hand to do. And that mindset, I was at E4, my first duty station, and I had E7s telling me, dude, you're already a dinosaur. Like, I couldn't evolve, like Steve was saying, I couldn't evolve into that whole person touchy-feely concept. Had an E7 come on night shift with me, and he rode for a night, and he goes, why aren't you an NCO? And I said, because I don't look good on paper. I know my job better than most. I'm really good at what I do. I take care of my guys. I don't look good on paper. And nobody promotes early if they don't look good on paper.
Right.
And that was my whole career. I didn't look good on paper. But if you wanted somebody to get something done, you ask me, I'm a fucker going to get done. I mean, I was always available. I was always there, but I wasn't the guy that looked good on paper, which is why when I got out at 9 years, I was still at E5. And, you know, I didn't promote fast because I didn't look good on paper, which I was okay with. Making rank was never my goal. I wanted to make a career out of it. But when I've said before, when I enlisted, I had an old chief master sergeant tell me when it stops being a way of life and it starts being a 9-to-5, it's time to look elsewhere. And I hit that brick wall at 8.5 years. But my whole goal was to just do my mission, fulfill my oath, and take care of my guys. If I did that, fuck it. It was a successful day for me.
Now a word from our sponsor, Ohio Cigar Mafia. Are you in the state of Ohio and a cigar enthusiast? Join the ranks of over 200 members who enjoy a good stick paired with a sip of their favorite spirit as they raise money for veterans. Ohio Cigar Mafia is a 501c3 who supports the Southeastern Guide Dogs. They allow veterans to witness a brighter future through the eyes of a service dog. Thank you, Ohio Cigar Mafia, for your support. Yeah, I mean, you know, I tell you, my goal was to be a first sergeant, like I said, and once you're in it, once you start doing it, you know, I made rank relatively, you know, I made E5 within 3 years, you know, relatively quickly, you know, and I was a team leader as an E4, my squad leader at the time didn't treat me, you know, as a team leader, right? He treated me like an E4. And I always, like, you know, it was one of those things where when you had to go up to the the company for whatever when it's, you know, all the enlisted, all the E4 and below, I had to go to that. And then they would have leader meetings, but I couldn't go to that. And then they'd put out something in the leader meeting, and then, you know, which I was unaware of, then, you know, why ain't you doing this? We put it out in the leader meeting, like I wasn't part of that, you know? So I'm like, okay, let me buckle down and go ahead and get promoted. You know, well, we'll make you a corporal. No, the fuck you won't. Again, from my experience with Corporal Ferguson, great fucking guy, bad fucking corporal. You know what I mean? Yeah. Bad fucking corporal.
So Trevor's a specialist in the National Guard. And I tell everybody all the time, I couldn't be his NCO. He takes fucking shamming to he is truly E4 mafia, shamming like there's no tomorrow. But hearing stories and stuff, I think it must be universal that the specialists and below cannot stand corporals right. in any way, shape, or form. Like, there's never a good thing said about corporals that I've ever heard anybody say. Like, it's just, I not having experienced that, because when I joined the Air Force, you know, we used to have, you had a senior airman and then you had a buck sergeant, which was like the Air Force's version of a corporal. That was phased out before I enlisted. So it was just E4, E5. We didn't have anything E4, five and a half-ish, you know. So I didn't have that experience. But, you know, hearing you guys talk about it and other guys talk about it, like.
But it's the funny thing is, corporal is a combined pay grade, right? Corporal and specialist in the Army, same. First sergeant, master sergeant, same. Sergeant major, command sergeant major, same. That disdain is only for corporals, right? I mean, that's it.
That's right.
I don't know if it's because the corporal rank has gotten that that fucking stigma of being the ass kisser. You know what I mean?
I think it's
because I've heard that a lot. Like, they're the ass kisser, or they're the fuck ups that you don't want to promote, but they've been in so long, you got to do something with them.
You know why it's a horrible rank? Because when you need an NCO to do something, that fucking guy's doing it. Right?
Yeah.
He's fucking doing it. Like every bullshit fucking goddamn area beautification detail, that motherfucker's on it. You know what I mean? And nobody wants to be that fucking guy. You know what I mean? And my approach was, I don't want to be a half NCO.
Right.
Right. I was never, you know, in the Army, we have this thing called, sitting, you know, acting yep. first sergeant, acting platoon sergeant, acting fucking whatever. You know what I mean? I was never an acting anything. Once someone says you're a team leader, I was a fucking team leader. And that was my mentality. Because acting as such is doing me a disservice and my guys. When I was in a position that wasn't supposed to be long, and they're like, hey, we're going to put you in here and you feel it and ba da 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 da. And I'm like, okay. And first day, I'm like, hey, listen, I may only be here 2 weeks. However, in the next 2 weeks, we're going to do shit my fucking way. And if you don't fucking like it, you know, you can come close the door. You know what I mean? But yeah, so, I never liked acting, air quotes, you know what I mean? That makes no fucking sense to me.
I don't think anybody did.
Right. And a lot of them corporals that was the, you know, air quotes acting, Because again, you know, at certain points, cutoff scores were fucking outrageous in some MOSs, and you know, low density MOSs were even worse, and things of that nature. But you know, at some point, you either have to fucking figure out, hey, you know, you're going to be a lifelong corporal, or you need to go do something else, reclass the, you know.
I've had that exact counseling session with numerous soldiers throughout my career. I'm like, look, guy, what is it that you want?
Right.
I mean, do you want to be an E5 the rest of your life, or do you want to move up? If you want to move up, then I recommend you start doing things like correspondence courses and you know, doing better on your PT test and, you know, all the things that you need to get advanced. And if they don't, then that's fine. You know, I'm not going to waste my time on you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I, as well, you know, when you have to come up and are you a 10? Are you promote, or are you able to reenlist? Or, you know, and things of that nature. And you're like, hey, listen, man, like, you have those people that you say, you're a good soldier, go work in PAC. You're a good soldier, go, don't try to be a combat armed soldier when you're not. You know what I mean?
Know your role.
You know what I mean? Like, I get, I understand. I understand when you went to MEPS, this was the only thing, you had a 97 GT score. This is the only thing you can get. I get it. Fucking go goddamn to BSEP, get right. And you're a good soldier. Army needs good soldiers, right? And then there's those, hey, bro, your fucking ETS day can get here soon enough, right? And I want to reclass. I want a bonus. No, the fuck. Yeah, that's what you want to do. But I can't in good faith allow the United States Army to fucking reenlist you, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of those. So the military, family lineage.
Right.
Yeah.
Grandparent. Both of my grandfathers were in the military. Army Air Corps on my dad's side and Navy on my mom's side. And then my dad was in Vietnam and, he made E5 and, you know, got out when he got back. And, you know, so I always wanted to, that's what I wanted to do. I never had any aspirations of going to college or anything like that. I wanted to be in the military. And my dad gave me the same speech that you got, you know, basic training, keep your mouth shut. Don't volunteer for shit. You know, lay low. Roger that. Get to basic training and your name spelled D-U-C-H, you don't get to lay too low, because when mail comes and somebody looks at the letter and they're like, Private Douche, I'm like, motherfucker. It's like, please let somebody step out of ranks and say here. But yeah, I couldn't lay low. Couldn't lay
too low. Right. Yeah. I mean, I get it. And I like to ask these questions because I had a grandfather I didn't know, World War II. I didn't know him. My other grandfather, he was a coal miner in a, for his whole adult life. And, my dad was a steel worker. And, so, you know, I didn't have the lineage. I didn't have, you know, some people have pressure to join the military. Some people, you know, I didn't have that. My mom's first husband, he died in Vietnam in 1970, about 4 months after my sister was born. And I think I was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old when I found the folded flag and his Bronze Star and Purple Heart. And then you have to, you know, being an inquisitive kid, you have to ask questions. Like, it never dawned on me until that point, like, me and my sister had different last names. You know what I mean? Like, it was, like, not a thing, right? Like, I never thought that we had different dads because my dad was always her dad, you know? Mm-hmm. Him and my mom got together when my sister was one and a half, or so. And got married when she was 2. So her whole life, she's only known one dad, right? But it weighed heavily on me as I grown to know that, you know, when we talk about sacrifice and the ultimate sacrifice, that there was a man who paid the ultimate sacrifice, and my existence is solely based off of that sacrifice. Like I made that, you know, I connected those dots early and I was like, holy shit. And so all throughout high school, there was no other goal for me than to be in the military. And again, I had offers to wrestle in college and play football in college. But I always wanted to join the military, but I knew what it would do to my mom. And, I knew, I was going against her wishes. Cause she damn near didn't want to lose a husband and a son. And,
got that
right. Yeah. So, but you have to do what you think you have to do, right? So that was the other reason why when I joined the Army, I'm not washing out. I felt like I had a debt owed. So that's kind of the chip I carried with me throughout my career, a debt owed. But then, once Iraq kicked off, or once 9/11 kicked off, my mom was like, "Hey, like, are you getting out of the Army?" Like, no, I'm not getting
negative Ghost Rider.
Right. No, like, hell, in 99, I was home for my dad's mother, my grandmother's funeral. And, that's when Kosovo kicked off, and I was on, orders to go to Fort Riley. I re-enlisted to go to Fort Riley, because I didn't know any better. I didn't know anything about Fort Riley, and, the Army threw a bonus at me and I was all about it. I was at home in arm's reach of my mother, and a buddy of mine calls and says, "Hey, have you been watching the news?" "Yeah." "You seen what's going on?" "Yeah." "You want to go?" "Yeah." He's like, "Well, you better get back here." I said, "Okay." And, so I told everybody, "Hey, I'm leaving." And they're like, "Oh, you were supposed to be here a week or whatever it was." And I'm like, something came up. I have to, and, went home. We didn't end up going to Kosovo. We ended up going to Kuwait. And they sent the unit that was in Kuwait to Kosovo because, they were best trained at the time. But we ended up spending 4 months in Kosovo in 99. But, but it was one of those things where, again, I'm a combat engineer that haven't been to combat. And this was an opportunity to go. So,
both grandfathers,
yep.
Dad was in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You said that was always a goal. Did you felt like it was, a family duty? Like, 'cause both my grandfathers were in, a lot of my uncles were, my dad raised me to, with the mindset that, you don't have to make a career out of it, but it's a family duty that you enlist. Like, our family owes, you owe this country as part of this family to carry on that duty to go and do your part, I guess is the way I want to put it.
Yeah, it wasn't instilled in me like that. Not with our family. It was just something that I wanted. I always saw my dad's uniform hanging in the closet with his stuff on it from Vietnam. And I'm like, that's, That's what I want. I want to do that. I want to be that. And so when I enlisted, the day that I left was the only time I ever seen my dad get with a tear in his eye. He gave me a hug, gave me the speech, had a tear in his eye. Out the door I went to MEPS, you know, and then off to basic training. And but, you know, being able to go and do that and be successful throughout my career made him proud. Obviously, you know, I'm his son, but it also made me proud to be his son and to have done those things and say, hey, look, Dad, you know, this is what I did. And I did it because of you.
Yeah.
So
my grandfather, my dad's dad, who you know made a long career out of it, he died in 76. I was born in 78. He would be what they would. I mean, he is the clinical definition of PTSD. You know what I mean? But you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s, it wasn't that. It was you know all kinds of other things. And so he medicated through alcoholism, and you know he was abusive and stuff like that. So I didn't know him, but even though I only spent 9 years in the career that I had or the time that I spent in, my dad, my grandmother, my uncles, they all told me, you know, out of all the grandkids, your grandfather would be most proud of you because of what you did and how he viewed that type of stuff. So like where I never actually had a connection with the man, knowing that what I did would have made him, you know, chest out and stuff like that. That kind of hit like that. Like now, and my dad's the same way. My dad gushes over me about certain mm-hmm. things like that. Especially, you know, with the problems he had in his time in the Army. But yeah, it's nice to know. Like you said, you had that, you know, your dad's proud of you because you're his kid, but he's also proud of the type of career that you had, you know, so right, that level of understanding is kind of nice.
I remember when I made E6, the first sergeant that I had, he was kind of the guy that groomed me. Like his name was Jacobson, First Sergeant Howard Jacobson. Awesome guy. He was a former Marine, transitioned to the Army, but he was one of those guys that taught me, you know, how to read people, you know, and he took me under his wing and he was like, look, this is what I want you. This is the path I want for you if you're going to make it and you're going to be successful. And, but anyway, when I got promoted to E6, they had got a hold of my wife who in turn got a hold of my dad, and my dad was there to pin me that day. And it was probably one of the best feelings that I ever had. In my whole military career was my dad put that rocker on me, mm-hmm. you know,
that's awesome.
It was an awesome day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my dad dropped me off at the MEP station as well. Well, he dropped me off at the recruiting station, over in Wheeling, to go to MEPS. You know, he's a guy of few words, right? I mean, he don't say a lot, has never said he was proud of me. But I know he is. He's one of those guys, right? So, you know, we're not a loving, openly outward loving family, but I know they love me. Kind of thing, you know, and I say that, you know, because my dad, everywhere the fuck we go, my dad will tell, hey, my son was in the Army 20 years. He fucking, you know what I mean? Like, so he's proud of me. You know what I mean? Like, he don't convey it to me personally, which is fine because, you know, we're not built for that heart-to-heart shit, me and right. my dad. But yeah, I mean, I get it.
The fact that he gushes over your
right.
service
yeah.
just lets you know. The fact that he's even voicing that lets you know just how important and special that is to him.
Yeah, because I'll be like, hey, Dad, this guy don't give a fuck. You know, we were at the Pirates game. He's like, hey, yeah, my, you know, my son, 20 years in the military. Oh, thank you for your service. I appreciate it. Dad, he don't give a fuck. Oh, no, I'm like, no, I get it. I mean, I get it. You give a fuck, but in the sense that you don't give a fuck as much as he gives a fuck. That's what I'm saying. Oh, yeah. He's like, you know, it's good. Your dad's proud of you. I'm like, I get that. But, you know, it don't need to be that type of thing. I'm not, you know. But yeah, my dad, but I think it's still, he grew up in a time when Vietnam was going on. You know, he didn't serve. But you know, in all accounts, he was one of the toughest dudes, I've ever met, you know, so I don't think, he would have been bad at serving, right. But I just think, you know, it wasn't in the cards. And that's also why I'm not a hypocrite when it comes to support members, you know, in our organization. I don't look down at them. I don't snub my nose and say I'm better than you because, you know, you, as long as, you know, you had enough intestinal fortitude to raise your hand and volunteer and say, this is what I want to do. If the Army didn't send you or your service didn't send you, that's not your fault per exactly. se. That's, yep.
You were there, but you know, you were willing and able and there, they just chose not to cash it is the way I look mm-hmm. at it, you know? So, and that's a struggle I have with my dad. You know, he was in from 80 to 84, never went to combat. Got himself in some trouble. You know, this was when the time the Army was cracking down on drugs and alcohol. 13 days left for his ETS, he got kicked out for third drug rehab failure. And he told him, I'm ETSing. I'm not staying in. And Captain wanted to make an example out of him, and example he was made. So he's very he's not ashamed that he served. He's very ashamed of how he served, I guess is the way I want to put that.
Yeah. And we've
had that conversation.
You get that though, right? I mean, yeah. especially now that he's around all of us a lot, you know what I mean? And be like, man, you know, and it's always what could have been. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a wrestling coach. He used to say all the time, he's like, don't be the guy sitting up at Dutch Henry's, which is a bar in Martins Ferry, not there anymore, burnt down. I hope they got the insurance money. But, but you know, don't be the guy up in Dutch Henry's saying, I could have been the best, whatever, 20 years from now. Because when you walked into Dutch Henry's, every dude in there, I should have been, you know, this person held me back or this person, you know, did that, this, that, and the other to me. Don't be a victim. Right. Yeah. And he coined that long before, you know, that was back in the '80s. He coined that shit. Don't be a victim and don't, what if will eat you up more than anything.
And I think that's something that dad's come to terms with is that, you know, it was his fuck up. You know, he was a good soldier. He just liked to party. And, you know, that it was at that time where, you know, partying was being phased out. And, you know, he was a fucking idiot.
Yeah. But they, as we all do, they have their own perception, right, of what their career was. And, you know, I've said it many times, I don't have the best, when I look at my career overall, I'm like, you know, I didn't achieve what I set out to achieve. So de facto, that's a failure, right? Now others, you know, others try to tell me differently. You ain't going to tell me differently. You know what I mean? Like, we're not going to tell your dad. We're not going to tell Link, you know, differently. You know, Link's like, man, I wish I was a full member or things of that nature. And I'm like, well, but he also acknowledges, I don't want to be fucked up like you. he also acknowledges that. He's like, you know, yeah, I didn't serve in combat, but I'm not fucked up like you.
So how do you view your career? Like, do you, like, we had, in our self-sabotage episode, we talked about how we don't view our service in the same light that other people do. You know, like, you know, we're not ashamed of the fact that we served, but not proud of certain, the way certain things went about and stuff like that, or our views of ourselves. And so, like, if, you know, Andy, now, when he looks back at Andy the private to Andy the sergeant major in retirement, how do you view your service? Like, is it something that, you know, is there any, like, regrets, things that you wish, you know, like major milestones that you wish you would have done differently, you know, things that you're not happy with, or, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, sure. There are certain parts of my career that I wish that, you know, I'd done things a little different. I'd had, took more time with some certain soldiers to get them in the right direction. You know, there for a while, and I don't know if this happens to everybody, but, you know, when you get up to like E7, E8, soldiers look at you different. They treat you different, and you're not like one of the Joes anymore. Like you're not associated with them as like you were when you was an E6, you know,
right.
You were with your Joes, you trained with them, you did everything with them. But when you get up in rank, it changes. And then when I made Sergeant Major, well, now, you know, all I did was counsel people, or all I did was, I would go visit my people every day. Every day I would go from shop to shop to shop. How you doing? What do you need? Is there anything I can do for you? I mean, other than the other shit that I had to do, that was my main focus every morning. I wanted to make my Joes know, hey, I'm here for you. You know, if you've got an officer that's up your ass, they don't need to be up your ass. That's my job, you know? So, you know, that part of it was different. I always thought, when you, like I said earlier, when we first started this, when you make Sergeant Major, then you can, you're the guy that can make shit happen. You can make the changes that need to be made that you've seen fucked up through your whole career. You know, when I make Sergeant Major, you know, I'm going to make this better. But you find out when you get there, you can't. I mean, there's certain things that you can influence and change, but then there's things that you're never going to be able to change because it becomes so political.
Yeah.
And that was so discouraging to me. You know, I fought so hard to get there, and then I got there and it wasn't what I thought it was going to be, you know? And then it got to be like you said earlier, like your one of your people told you, if it becomes a 9-to-5, then it's time to do right. something else. And, you know, and that's where I got, yeah. I got to where, you know, this isn't fun anymore. It's time for me to go, you know, 25 years is a good run.
Yeah. It wasn't a, like for the longest time, it was, I didn't get up in the morning and go to work. I was living a life 24/7. And then at my 8.5 year mark, it was, I woke up one day and I'm like, oh, I gotta fucking go to work. And then it was like, oh shit, I'm going to work, you know, like, and it wasn't there anymore. And, you know, being raised the way I was and the type of NCO I was, if I wasn't in it all the way, then it wasn't worth being in it because there was an oath that I took that was very important to me. So, and I had long talks with the wife and my dad and my E7, Master Sergeant John Daly, fucking amazing guy, probably the best E7 and supervisor I had my whole career. We spent a lot of time talking, and he tried like hell. I give the man credit. He tried like hell to keep me in. But I just, my mind was made up and I was done. But when you come out of the shop there in Utah and you round the corner at Hill at the North Gate, there's this massive, giant, massive base flag. You know, you see them at all the gates. Every time I'd make that curve, I'd see that flag. I'd think, I'm quitting. I'm a quitter. I'm failing my guys. I'm leaving them. And so for every day for 6 weeks, man, I'd make that curve. And every day I'd be like, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? And I just had to keep telling myself, man, yeah, it's not. And, you know, there's days I look back and I would have retired. I would have hit my 20 years in 2017. And sometimes I wish I would have stayed in, but I knew it that I know now at the time it was the right decision for me because I couldn't have been the type of NCO that I envisioned myself being if I would have stayed in. I'd have turned into one of those shit bags and sure. I just that wasn't me.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in Afghanistan, and we was with an OMLET, you know, operational mentor liaison team. So we trained the ANA and took them up north. But I was
now in, I know what that stands for.
I was an E9, right?
Right.
So I had a E5 that was supposed to be my gunner in my truck, and I had the commander with me because you know, commander and sergeant major, you know, we're buddies. But I could see that he was scared, and I pulled him off to the side. I'm like, hey, man, are you going to be okay up there? I mean, you got – we're the ones that you got to make sure stays okay. He's like, Sergeant Major, I don't think I can do it. I'm like, do you know how to drive one of these motherfuckers? He's like, yeah. I said, you drive, I'll gun. So I was a gunner for the commander the whole time I was in Afghanistan. And all the other – my other Joes, they'd be like, hey, Sergeant Major, what are you doing up there? I'm like, look, man, somebody's got to do this. He's scared, and I'm not going to have somebody up there that's right. scared. You know what I mean?
That's
But these that created a relationship with the rest of my guys that was with me on that team that I still have today. Like these guys still get a hold of me and like, hey, Sergeant Major, you know, I got this going on. What's your take? What would you do? You know, and that makes me feel awesome. Yeah. You know, to still have that, and just like with you guys, you know, like it's great that we can talk about things with many similarities
yeah.
and be able to share our stories, not just on this podcast, but with each other and walk away from a time that we've had together and be like, you know what? That's some good shit. Yeah. You know, I want to do this some more.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I was a fucking lower enlisted guy and I seen my sergeant major up in a fucking turret, I'd have been like, That's the baddest motherfucking E9 around. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, because it's just in my brain, I don't think I can envision your average sergeant major telling the E5 jump in the driver's seat. I'll gun this motherfucker. You know what I mean? Like, that's mind boggling to me.
Right.
I don't know if it's something that you saw often or if that was one of those things where you were just like.
But I mean, you're what, 28 man team or
right, yeah.
28 man group. So, I mean, it's slim pickings.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
It wasn't like we had like six trucks. So everybody had a role.
Right.
And it wasn't like there wasn't anybody that was just sitting in a seat not doing shit. You know, so either you as a driver or you were manning the BFT or you were gunning.
Right.
You know. Everybody had to do that.
Yeah.
I guess I think a lot of, and I may just be assuming, but I think a lot of individuals in your position, not with your mindset, but your position would have just been like, well, fucking suck it up E5 and run that gun. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm sure that happened.
Yeah. I mean, I had, you know, first sergeant's like, hey, I'm coming out on your patrol with you. And I'm like, listen, I don't need a fucking babysitter. No, I'm going to be your gunner. Or not gunner, but I'm going to be a rifleman. All right. Something happens. I'm holding you to that shit. Mm-hmm. So when I say fucking Ward, move your ass over there. Don't expect the first sergeant behind him. Fucking move. You know what I mean? And to his credit, when fucking first sergeant Ward rode with me one day and an IED goes off, and I can tell you about 25 IED went off stories because I was called the IED magnet. Anyways, but when it went off, he knew his role and allowed me to maneuver like I was trained to do. So
that's a good first sergeant.
Yeah, most certainly. He was.
He was a real good first sergeant.
But I had a soldier, Benny Montez. Shout out to Benny Montez if you're listening. He was with me. He was my gunner, the day I got injured. But Benny Montez, he would have, panic attacks, at NTC. And, we had a mishap with some smoke pots from the OCs. We were setting up a checkpoint. Doing checkpoint operations out at NTC, and the OCs set off two smoke pots and it just devoured our whole checkpoint. And my driver and gunner and the Bradley that I had overwatching being good fucking soldiers and not being relieved of their fucking, you know, general order number one, they stayed in that fucking Bradley and smoked his rolled. And when I pulled everybody off, you know, here I am. I think I was E7 then. Yeah, I was E7 then. NTC is controlled, right? Controlled by the OCs, controlled by every mission is controlled. And I'm just like, get the fuck out. You know what I mean? And brought my whole platoon off that checkpoint and do a head count. I'm missing two. I'm like, all right, stand by. Let me go in and get them. I knew exactly where they was. I walked through the smoke. I opened the back hatch of that fucking Bradley. I'm like, hey, boys, get the fuck out of here. You know, they're, yeah. I mean, one of the guys had to be medical evac'd. Mm. He had a disorder that was not, and he started convulsing after that. And so much so that he couldn't stay in the Army any longer. We all three of us had smoke inhalation and all this stuff. So I was not out for like the next two iterations. Montez was my gunner, and he had panic attacks. And you know, my commander was like, hey, I think Montez is unfit for the Army. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? He's like, he keeps having panic attacks. He's like, well, it's better we know now than when we get to Iraq. And I'm like, there's fucking nothing wrong with Montez. Right. So I'm like, all right, no worries. I go back. I'm like, you know, I go back. I'm in the vehicle. Montez is in the vehicle. Stolp's in the vehicle. And we're riding. And I'm like, you know, hey, Montez, how you doing? Good, Sergeant. All right. We'll fucking keep riding. How you doing? Good, Sergeant. Okay. Fucking get done with the mission. After the mission, I'm like, hey, what the fuck? He's like, I don't know what it is. And I'm like, I don't know what it is either. He's like, Sergeant, he's like, I'm so comfortable with you. He's like, I got in somebody else's truck and I was like, this is going to the shit in a handbag. Right. He's like, I think that's it. I'm like, all right, cool. I got it. Right. So I go to the commander. I'm like, he's good. Like, you know, now both times that dude passed out in the fucking turret.
Damn.
Passed out from fucking anxiety or whatever. Took him to Iraq. He was my gunner every fucking day. When I got injured, he was also in the truck with me. So he was off 72 hours as I was. So, but every time, but when I went on leave, he had a fucking panic attack.
You were his security blanket.
And my squad leader that I put in charge of the platoon when I was gone, he, you know, sent me an email. Everything's good. Montez has another panic attack. I said, you put him in operations until I get the fuck back. Because we don't need him having a panic attack and not being on the gun when he needs to be on the gun. I'm like, just swap him out. Like, I'll send First Sergeant a fucking email, explain it. Swap him out. When I get back, he'll be fine. And it is. And you know, it's one of those things where that motherfucker was in a vehicle that got hit with seven explosive force penetrators at one time. And, you know, he's good. You know what I'm saying? But there was one time he don't show up for PT. It's like, what the fuck? So, squad leader, where the fuck Montez at? I don't know. Like, all right, well, we need to figure it out. Like, you fucking, after PT, go over to his house, figure it out. So he calls me from his house. He's like, he's not here. I'm like, well, go over to Flewellen's house. Them two were fucking thick as thieves. And so he's like, fucking Flewellen don't know. I'm like, all right. So I go over to his house and, you know, I start looking through the windows and there's fucking 20 fucking tall boys on the fucking coffee table. So I, you know, I kind of, I move the window open and, you know, move the curtain. I said, Montez, if you're fucking in here, I'm coming in. If you fucking shoot me, I'm going to be pissed off. I don't know where the fuck you're at, but if you're in here and he fucking come out, you know, Sergeant, I'm here. I'm like, get your fucking ass out of here. You know what I mean? I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Oh, I'm, you know, I'm having a bad time. Like, fuck, we're all having a goddamn bad time. You know what I mean? Like, god damn. So, you know, in the army, right? You know, the definition of leadership is the ability to accomplish the mission. Well, the ability to will others to accomplish a mission by providing purpose, direction, and motivation. That I'm sure I hacked that up, but I'm going off of my memory.
Paraphrasing.
Yeah, right. I think you're close enough for government work.
Right. But I think part of my problem is I lost that. I lost the leadership aspect of my life. And my identity was so consumed with being a leader. And I'm one of those leaders where I had, you know, invisible badges, you know, I had the badge of being that guy. My leadership called on when there was hard tasks. You know what I mean? I was that guy.
Like, they don't want to know how it got done. They just need it done.
Or like in Iraq when, you know, we had a patrol ambushed. They said, all right, we're going to run 24-hour roving patrols. They said, you got engineers, you got the first roving patrol. Vic, you got the first roving patrol. Roger that. You know what I mean? Like, it was every tough, right, quote-unquote tough mission, every high visibility mission, every no fail mission, every, you know, all those. And, you know, again, my squad leaders were like, what the fuck, man? Like, hey, there's a high likelihood we're going to get fucked up right now. They'd be like, and you said okay to this? I'm like, like, we got to do something while we're here, right? I mean, fuck. Like, yeah, there's a high likelihood we're getting fucked up tonight. You know, and that, you know, it was to a point they're like, it's a high likelihood we get fucked up every time we leave this goddamn gate. And I'd be like, yeah. So, and I think because I was at Fort Benning for so long, there 10 years, unheard of. It, you know, each leader enabled me to be good at Fort Benning, right? I was a great leader at Fort Benning. The army, the rest of the army didn't see it, couldn't see it. But you know, it's one of those things where every leader that I had, when a new one came in, they said, hey, something goes wrong. Look at Sergeant Vickers. And it was like that when I was in the company. Right. It got to the point where, you know, new E7s were getting promoted. They, you know, the army's downsizing, they're shifting. They have a new company and there's only one fucking E7 with platoon sergeant time in the goddamn company. They're like, all right, hey, sergeant, we need you to go to fucking brigade. Like, and I'm like, all right. You know, which I never wanted to be on brigade staff, right? Because I was like, this is not my fucking cup of tea. You know what I mean? Like, but I quickly became that guy up at brigade. Okay, fuck, go ask our Vickers. You know what I mean? And I never shunned people to come and ask me. You know what I mean? Because I took it, again, as that invisible badge of, well, you want to know the right answer, so you came to the right guy. It was that sort of thing. And which quickly, you know, the Army, again, the Army revolving, like we, in my brigade, we had one true staff sergeant major, right? Which growing up, we used to have two, you know, future ops and plans. We had two, and then it just became one, and then it became an E8 in that position. Then it became a Sergeant Vickers. Until that guy gets here, you're fucking it. Okay. Which again, I'm never acting, right? So when the command sergeant major says Sergeant Vickers is a guy, well, fuck, that's all I need. And when I go and talk to, you know, other operation sergeants or their first sergeants, like I'm not saying, hey, would you guys please, you know what I mean? Like, so it wasn't until I got to, Fort Leonard Wood at the last 2 years of my career where I was not that guy. I was not hailed at all. It was actually the opposite. As soon as I got there, dude's like, well, you're a fat ass. And I'm like, well, yeah, I broke my fucking neck. So I don't PT like I used to. And I'm one of those guys that need to PT all the fucking time to maintain my weight. And when I'm not, you know, PTing, my weight will fluctuate. Oh, by the way, I'm still way under fucking body fat standards because the Army's body fat standards are fucking horrible. Mm-hmm. Right. And, hell, I think I'm at fucking like 22% body fat right now on according to 600-9. So, that's how horrible that shit is. Cause you know, when you have a 22 inch neck and a 40 inch waist, you will not blow tape at all.
Ever.
So, you know, but it was one of those things where, my last, like I told you guys with that picture from Bike and Rib Fest, like, why didn't you all tell me last year I was this fucking fat, right? Like, yes, I can see it, right? I can see it, but you don't see it, right? Like in the military, yes, I could see where I need another jacket. I need another, you know what I mean? Like, you can see it, but you don't, because everyone around you is not saying, hey, fat ass, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? You need to go to the fucking whatever. Because they still held me in so high esteem, which I let myself down. I let them down, you know, and that's where I used my neck as a crutch. I used it as an opportunity to take a knee at a time where I never took a knee. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I thought poorly of myself, not others. I believe there's a very distinct line between being hurt and being injured. If you're fucking injured, fucking help yourself. If you're hurt, then rub a little dirt on that son of a bitch and keep going. If you can't keep going, then you're probably injured and let's get it fixed. But yeah, again, I held myself to a different standard. And when I couldn't lead the way I was used to, that's what sent me. I started becoming that hypocrite. I started becoming the person that I personally didn't like. And then other people started, you know, my family started not liking that person. And then, but then you go to Fort Leonard Wood and those guys were like, we don't fucking like you, fat ass. And I'm like, that's cool. I don't want to hang out with none of you motherfuckers anyways. And it left me with a horrible taste in my mouth. Because I'm getting a dose of that good, counseling that I used to give people, right? Like, hey, I think it's time for you to go fucking throw fries in a grease. And people were giving that to me and I'm like, motherfuckers,
mm-hmm.
like
I'm that guy.
Right.
You don't ETS me.
I'm break glass in case of war guy. Right. Like, no matter if I'm 290 pounds, I will get in a motherfucking MRAP right now. I would be the first dude on the ground at any intersection. You know what I mean? Like, I used to get back in my truck and I'd look over at Stolp. I'm like, hey, listen, don't tell my wife I just did that dumb shit. Right. Because, you know, she would be very upset knowing how close she was with getting $500,000 because I didn't fucking die right now. But yeah, I mean, but that's, you know, I think that started my spiral of, and it started before I got out. Plus I'm living in a 20-foot fucking camper. That don't help good mental health. And you're trying to, you know, you're trying to patch, fix a marriage from 1,300 miles away. That don't work. And yeah, so when I got out, I'm going to be a Franklin County sheriff. And then, you know, my mental health guy is like, well, you say you have irritability issues. Yeah. You understand inmates... Their goal every day is to fucking irritate the fucking guards. Oh yeah, fuck them. I don't, you know, like maybe it's not a good, you know. And then he's like, oh, and then you just had neck fusion surgery 3 months ago. Yeah, well we can't insure you. I'm like, okay, but this is my plan A. He's like, well, you might want a plan B. He's like, fuck. You don't do plan Bs, man. Like, I'm a plan A fucking attack guy. And yeah.
So when you retired, was your identity still wrapped up in Sergeant Major Duke and not Andy? Or, you know, was that a transition that was a natural flow for you? Or, you know, were you still, you know, in that mindset like Steve was, like, you know, like – I'm that guy, and now that I'm not that guy, what the fuck am I?
That's where I was. And it took me a while to cope with, I'm not the Sergeant Major anymore.
Right.
You know, I don't have soldiers anymore, you know. And I can remember a girl that I dated specifically at that time said to me one day, I'm not one of your soldiers, and you are not my Sergeant Major. And, you know, that was like a dagger. And I'm like, well, you bitch, why would you say something like that? But she was right. And I had a real hard time transition because the Army doesn't have a good, they don't have an SOP or a manual that they hand you when you're walking out the door that says, all right, this is what you need to do to transition to be a civilian. You go through the TAP process and right. You go through Fort Knox for out processing and you're down there for a couple of days and you see all these people and they give you a flag and a lapel pin and they pat you on the back and say, thanks, you're fucking out of here.
Yep.
And then you're like, okay. You had a plan A. I didn't have a plan anything. I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, I was a fucking Sergeant Major, so this should be easy. No, it's not. So you know what I ended up doing? I worked at fucking Home Depot for like 6 months, and I'm like, this isn't for me. You know, these people that I'm working with, they don't have what I'm used to. You know, there's no loyalty or pride in their work or mission essential anything with these fuckers. So I was like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm not going to do it. So I was talking to my shrink at the VA and she's like, hey, have you ever thought about the vocational rehabilitation program? I'm like, what is it? And she told me what it was. And I'm like, well, so I get to go to college for free. And she's like, yeah, maybe you ought to try that. they'll pay you to go to school. I'm like, pay me? Okay, I'll do it. So I went and got my degree in associate's degree in applied science and learned how to work on air conditioners and furnaces. And then it came time for me to do my first install, and my fucking back won't let me do it. So I'm like, I can't do that. I can't do this job. So now what the fuck am I going to do? You know? So then I ended up not doing anything. You know, I ended up just figuring out how to survive on my military pension and my disability. And now I'm just, I do what I want to do. Now I just, I don't report to anybody. I don't have keys to anything. I just do whatever I want to do. And 9 out of 10 times it's with you guys.
Yeah.
Because that's what I want.
There it is.
Yeah. It's when, and it's funny hearing you guys, you know, 22 years E7, 25 years E9. Talk about how there's like you're not prepared to transition back. Think about those E4s and E5s that don't even have that structure in their life. And the Army's like, good game. See you on your way. And then those kids, you know, they know even less about what's available or how to do things. And that starts a nasty spiral. So like I didn't know a lot when I got out, and because of the short time that I did, I didn't get to go through TAPS or anything like that. So when I got out, it was clean break. And then I went over to Iraq, and I was a contractor for 5 years with KBR. My whole first year, I struggled with looking down and seeing a t-shirt and jeans when I drove around Victory Base and not a uniform, because I'd see fucking airmen and privates fucking up. And like I a couple of times I stopped the truck, put it in park, got ready to get out and chew some ass. And I'm like, I'm not that guy. Put it back in drive, and it'd fucking eat at me. And it took a while for me to get to the point where I could be like, just you're just Sean. You're not Sergeant Neighbor anymore. You're just Sean. And it, you just got to figure that out. And I struggled from 06 when I got out till 2021 to find that home. And I did not find that home. I started to kind of see a peek behind the curtain in September of 21 when I met him up at the 12-7 event in Willoughby. But it wasn't until the truck ride in February of 22 to Vermont that I finally realized, okay, this is where I'm going to get to be. I'm not Sergeant Neighbor anymore, but I'm with people who understand who Sergeant Neighbor was and how my time as Sergeant Neighbor impacts how I see the world, how I interact with the world. And they don't just look at me. I mean, I'm an asshole, but they don't look at me as just, well, you're just an asshole. There's reasoning and understanding as to why I do the things that I do, and to be with people. And that's why, you know, over 12,000 miles, you know, when I hit my funk over the holidays, we talked about this, just spending that little bit of time at the bowling alley, getting to talk to you guys and Sarge, snapped me back. And it's because nobody else can give me that. I don't have that home. You know, you came to the chapter at about the same time I joined. And I've kind of seen the same thing with, like, your and I's trajectory in the chapter has been very similar. You know, like fitting in and finding that spot and coming through it. And I kind of see that parallel with you as well in the fact that this chapter is, and I think I'm not trying to pat your chest, Mr. Bromance, but I think that the impact that this chapter has on individuals with our mindset can directly be attributed to the fact that the commander of this chapter leads the way he leads.
100%.
And that right there.
And he's so fucked up.
It's that invisible badge that he wears.
Right. It's that leadership quality that he portrays is whatever that people like you, me, Sarge, the guys that were those types of NCOs are like, huh, I get this motherfucker. Mm. I get this motherfucker because this motherfucker gets me and we're on that same wavelength. And I think that that's why some individuals don't do well in our chapter because they don't have that type of mentality. You know what I mean? I can't, even when I was Sergeant Major or Sergeant Neighbor, I couldn't be Sergeant Neighbor at home. I walked through the door and my wife was an E4 at the time. She's like, look, motherfucker, rank stays outside. So that I had no world outside of being enlisted where I could be who I was until I got linked up with you guys. And you know, being able to find those commonalities and all of that is a, I think, a direct result of how he leads. And I know that the chapter was here before he was the commander and the groundwork was set by Bobby and all those guys. But I think that leadership that he's been able to give to everyone has helped push the chapter forward, helped it grow. And in February, when he's no longer the commander, the next person's got, they don't have to be like Steve, but they have an expectation that they need to surpass, I guess is the best way to put it.
I agree 100%. Yeah. I love what we have. I mean, we're talking about leadership today, and you know, you're ending on a perfect point, because I was in 12-1 for 10 years and never felt one day like I did the first day I met this guy. And I'm like, you know, there's something about him that's different. There's something about him that makes me want to be here. And it's the way he carries himself, and it's the way he leads. And what we talked about in the very beginning of this is, you know, how you can read people and how, you know, some people have it and some people don't. Yep. He's got it.
Yep.
And everybody wants to follow it.
Yep.
And it's obvious. I mean, look how much time we spend together when we're not doing something specific to the CVMA or right. or just motorcycles. You know, we still like to, like you said at the bowling, I knew that was good for you. I called you and I was like, hey, man, you good? And you were like, man, I feel better now.
Yeah, I got my battery recharged.
I think we all get that way.
Yeah.
But going back to this guy, it's so refreshing to be amongst men and women that make you feel like you are a part of a family. And that's what I love the most about all of this, is I feel like I'm part of a family that I had lost when I got out of the military.
Right. And thank you for the flowers. I appreciate it. But I think it's important to know, it's easy, right? When you don't feel like you're leading, right? You know, when you say these nice things, I'm like, well, I haven't really done shit, right? Because I'm just who I am. People accept me for, you know, I can joke about my flaws with everybody, right? Because, again, I notice them as well as everyone else. But to be able to be yourself, to be your authentic self, and no one judges you to be that person. And, you know, when you, you know, up at that 12-7 event, you're like, hey, man, you know, I really don't like people. I'm like, cool, neither do I, right? You know, but you're the commander of a bunch of people. Yeah, but only half of those motherfuckers show up. So, you know what I mean? But it's, again, I'm going to be who I am regardless, because when I lost myself before, I hated myself because of that. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to lose myself again. So I don't care how many friends I have, when I'm my authentic self, when I'm lying and I'm doing all these other things and I'm not being my genuine self, I got fake friends. And they don't last, you know? So I don't, the numbers don't really matter. Like you said, you only need three motherfuckers.
That's it.
Take over the world. You only need three. You don't need 20 friends. Yeah. You only need three motherfuckers.
Joey Diaz.
And that's, you know what I mean? Like, it resonates because, you know, I don't need 20 goddamn, I don't think my life is built to have 20 good friends. There's a reason why there's like eight chairs in this bar, right? That's strategic, bro. It's strategic. There's fucking 8 chairs in this bar.
I thought it was just because of all the shelves of whiskey, but you know, now it makes sense, right? You know?
I mean, but there's always been 8 seats in here. Before that, there was 4 bar stools and 4 bar stools, but for a while, you know, we built it and I'm like, one person will come over, 2 people, you know what I mean? Or whatever. But now that you get 8 people in here and it's plenty full and you know, it's what it's all about. And when you get to be your authentic self and you're not faking and nobody gives a shit, right? We all been to combat. Nothing sets yourself apart.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Just be authentic, be real. The stories you tell, they gotta be 5% true and they have to start with no shit. There we were, you know what I mean? And, but yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where in order for me to evolve, to get to the place I am today, I had to kill Sergeant First Class Vickers, kill him off. And, I keep bringing up, the buddy that calls me all the time and we talk all the time and he's so stuck in the past, man. We used to be some bad motherfuckers. Yeah. Guess what? The motherfuckers are dead. You know what I mean? I'm like, bad, you took 7.62 to the fucking bicep, bro. Right? That's a bad motherfucker. And you had presence of mind to stay in the moment and help your teammates help you. That's a bad motherfucker. You're that guy, right? I'm like, but that guy, you know what I mean? He's gone. You know what I mean? And
the world doesn't need that guy anymore.
No. And he's been jumping around from job to job to job to job. And he's like, I can't find what we had. I'm like, you ain't going to find that. You know what I mean? You ain't going to find that, right? I'm like, but there's things out there that are fucking close. You know what I mean? And, but yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where when we met at 12-6 run and, hey, this is my dad, you know, great. And I'm coming over to the chapter, fucking great. And then we met again, Zanesville Moose. That was the first meeting you came over.
First right. one I was at.
Yeah. And I told Chrissy, I'm like, this can go one of 2 ways. And she's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, he was a sergeant major in the Army. So this can go one of 2 ways. I mean, he can fucking know everything and let you know that he knows everything, or he'll be one of the guys. And I thank you for being one of the guys. I appreciate that shit because I consider you a good friend and I'm glad you came down. I'm glad you ride as much as you do. I'm glad. either way, I was going to be the way I was. So,
Well, to that point, when we got done with that meeting and Brandy's like, oh, she's like, Duke is so nice and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the, like you said, when you see the sergeant major, you think differently. I'm like, oh, fuck, man, this is going to be I don't know how this is going to go, you know, because the same thing, you know, is he going to be the guy that is just the guy, or is he the guy that's still hung up on being a sergeant major?
Right.
And like Steve said, you're not hung up on being a sergeant major. We get to fuck with you so much about it because, well, when you're, you know, when you get out as an E5, you can fuck with the E9 now and have some humor with it. But, yeah, you're just Andy. You're just yeah. Duke. You know, yeah. it's, you know.
Yeah. I had to do what Steve said. You know, I had to kill the sergeant major off because it was hard. You know, it was making me somebody that I didn't. You know, and being, like I said, the transition to civilian life, it's not fucking easy.
No.
And, you know, and when you're doing it, coming from, you know, being the highest enlisted rank that the Army has to offer to just being a regular guy that nobody gives a shit about, you know, it takes a little bit off your plate. And, but
I still think it catches you off guard a little bit though, because the last night we were all here and, Duchess said something like, I don't give a fuck Sergeant Major or something like that. Like you didn't like like have this big reaction, but there was just a look in your face, like
a little twinkle,
like, little like twinkle. get you.
I'm like, come here, brother.
little twinkle. And it's, but yeah, it has been so therapeutic for me to leave. I'm proud to be a veteran. I'm proud to be a combat veteran. I'm proud to be, you know, I can compartmentalize now of being a veteran, and I treat veteran as past tense. Now we come on here and we speak about, all the things that encompass that. And again, I'm proud to be a veteran, but that fucking guy, is gone, you know, but it's still cool when people hit me up on Facebook and say, Sergeant Vic, you know what I mean? Like, it's still like, bro, we're, you know what I mean? Like, and some of those motherfuckers are E8s now or fucking, you know what I mean? And you're like, God damn, bro. Like, but yeah, like you said, it's always cool when, them guys, you know, reach out to you and, appreciate what you did. You know, like at the time they didn't understand the method in the madness. You know, they just thought I was a dude that fucking yelled all the goddamn time. But it's when soon's chaos erupted, there was a lot of quiet in the chaos, and they didn't necessarily hear me yelling in the chaos because everything calmed down, and that I think contributed to a lot of success we had in Iraq and in a lot of situations. And I only say that because people have come back and said, hey, listen, like, I don't lead like you now. Like, but I take a lot of things from the way you led. He's like, you know, I don't have the vernacular in my cuss words to fucking lead like you. And I'm like, well, you know, it's a science. It's a science.
What we've said before, and I'm sure you probably feel the same way, as an NCO, the greatest feeling and compliment you can get is when one of your guys calls you, emails you, whatever, and says, thanks. I get it now. Thanks. I only did this because of you, or whatever it is, that the message that they give you. Nothing I've ever received my time in the Air Force competes with a phone call I got from, or no, an email I got from one of my guys when he left a duty station and went to another one and emailed me back and said, thanks. If it wouldn't have been for you, I'd have been lost in the fucking sauce when I got here. And I, like, I hold that message in such high esteem that, I mean, it's not something you can pin on your chest or anything like that.
It's invisible.
It's invisible. That was 17, 18 years ago. And still to this day, that is something that I take as my best accomplishment.
Is that,
hey, and he went on to have a good career. And I, you know, I don't take credit for his good career. I take pride in his good career.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And like I said, I had a soldier say he fucking hated me. I fucking hate you, like, to my face. And I let him live because I'm a nice guy. after that deployment, boom, he goes to Fort Hood and emails me, you know, a couple of years later. He was a specialist. Yeah, a specialist then. When he became E6, he emailed me and said, I fucking get it. I said, that's all it takes. That's all I need.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I fucking get it. I apologize. I get it. Right? But you don't have to. It's called leadership, not likership.
Exactly.
You don't have to fucking like me. You just got to do what the fuck I. As long as you're confident that I'm not putting you in dangerous war aside, I'm not putting you in, you know, dangerous situations, you're going to do what the fuck I say, period. And so, yeah, and when he's like, hey, I get it. That's it. That's all I need. Like, you know,
I equate it to when I became a father. And when I became a father, then you call your dad up and you're like, I got you. Right. I understand now. Yeah. Like, things fall into place when you become a dad. You're like, that shit makes sense now. Like, my dad and I's relationship got so much stronger after I became a dad. And then I understood the decisions that he made when I was growing up. At the time, I thought they were fucking asinine or stupid, or that he didn't love me, or like there was some shit that went down. But now, you know, I became a dad. I'm like, oh, well, this motherfucker was just stupid, young, didn't know, did the best he could, thought he was doing the right thing. And in the end, it worked out great. But mm-hmm. yeah. And I think it's the same thing. I think when those guys that you try to mentor and lead, when they become that, then that they get that click, and then you call back and you kind of feel like your dad did when you called him back and be like, ah, I get it now. You know, like, well, all right, it makes sense.
Well, yeah.
But I think it's important that everyone understands that regardless of your rank, regardless of your trials and tribulations and the baggage you brought into the military and the greater baggage that you left the military with, you know what I mean? It's like that we were issued a rucksack in CIF when we were a private, and we just kept piling that son of a bitch up for 20 years. And we left the military.
You can put a lot of shit in one of them rucksacks.
We left the military with a lot of baggage. And some of that was good baggage. Some of that, you know, is shit we needed to jettison. But I think it's good that people understand, regardless of your rank, regardless of the situation where you found yourself in the military, that everyone has baggage. It's all about how you deal with the baggage. And what you don't want to do is allow that to be a weight, right? Allow it to drown you, allow it to be so much weight that you walk yourself to death, or break your back or whatever analogy you want to use. Sometimes you have to jettison, you have to, you know, discard some of that baggage. You know, I tell Chrissy all the time, I'm not a huge nostalgic person. You know, I don't keep a lot of my military stuff around the house or things that, you know, I'm not huge on symbolism. But that's me. People are, and that's great. But part of my transition was jettisoning that stuff. So that dude is dead. I don't have very few military items left. So we ride. So that's how we get our leisure. You ride as well. Hunting, huge.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Hunting, huge.
Called in some turkeys this morning.
Right. Yeah. So that, I mean, is that equal? Like, do you, what's the question?
It's like how we asked Gary last week.
Yeah. How do you equate the therapy, right? From riding a motorcycle into hunting. Is it equal? Is it, I need some of this? You know what I mean? Like, is it like ingredients to the cure, or, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
right. Yeah. I'm a big outdoors person, period. You know, so whether it's on a motorcycle or in a tree stand, as long as I'm out doing something outside, that's my comfort zone.
Okay.
You know, my mom, when I first came home and I was having issues, she said, why don't you just come down to the farm and spend some time in the woods? That's where you seem to be, you know.
Right.
That's your peace. And I was like, you know, she's right. But The motorcycle riding is probably the most important aspect of my ability to let things go and just be free. And, you know, and that comes back to when that motorcycle riding season is over and I can't get that anymore. That, when we was talking about the funk and stuff, but to answer your question, probably, the most important thing to me is riding the bike, is getting out there with you guys and just letting it all go, you know, not having a care in the world except for, you know, where we're going to stop and eat, that type of thing.
Yeah. And again, we asked everybody this question because we want other people to find their thing, their leisure, whatever that their, you know, what associates us are motorcycles. That's what made us become friends. It's evolved into much more than that, but you know, but again, there's more to us than motorcycles, you know, fixing everything else, the gearhead over there, fixing everything else out. You know, I'm not a huge, outdoorsman. I find frustration as you would, you know, as we talked about earlier, you find frustration where, you know, turkeys come up when you're not hunting turkeys, you know? And, I don't have the patience for it anymore. You know, I don't have the passion to hunt anymore. However, you know, I do apply every year to go hunt moose up in Alaska. I mean, I'll suck up a bad day in the woods in Alaska, right? I mean, it's not the back 40 here in Ohio. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I need something like hunting bear with a pistol in 2 rounds. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if I don't have the equal chance of fucking dying in this exchange, you know what I mean? I don't have that thrill, but that's me. Yeah, I tell Chrissy all the time, I'm like, let me take my 44 mag and go bear hunt. She's like, that's crazy. I'm like, yeah, that's the point. You know what I mean? That's the point.
Winnie the Pooh's gonna fucking die.
Right. Like that's the point. So you're a whiskey enthusiast.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely.
Not quite as enthused as you, but I'm getting there.
It's baby steps, man.
That's right.
Right.
It's a long road from one bottle to whatever this quantity is.
which, you know, again, I say I'm not into symbolism, but yet here we are. This is my symbol of whiskey does not have power over me anymore. And yet here we sit amongst 200 bottles. We don't need to drink to have a good time, but it helps. And a lot of our good times are surrounded by whiskey. So as long as we're not spitting on our boots outside, we're good. So if to put a bow on it, if you had to tell people that are transitioning from the military out to the real world,
it's 2023. There's levels to this shit.
When you're transitioning from the military out into the real world, give some SAR major advice to those people that some advice you never had that you thought, well, if I knew then what I know now, let me tell young private specialist Sergeant Duke, how to help transit. One nugget, if you have one.
I mean, one thing would just be, you know, wherever you're transitioning from the time that you leave to where you're now a civilian, leave all that other shit behind.
Yeah.
Because if you bring it with you, it's going to make life rough.
Right. Facts.
Big facts.
All right. Well, Duke, we appreciate you coming on with us, taking the time. You know, we had to get our schedules right. You know, three guys that don't work had to get our schedules right. I don't know how that works, but I'm glad it did. I'm glad you came on.
Busy doing nothing.
I'm glad you support the podcast outside of being on it.
Absolutely.
But being on it, we appreciate you.
Yep.
And we'll see y'all next time. We encourage your feedback and want to hear your stories. Hit us up, whiskeywillswounds.com. You'll find links to our social media and email. Remember, everyone deployed around the world, those still missing in action and prisoners of war, the homeless veterans in this country, and those veterans lost to suicide each year. Find a reason, not an excuse.
Thank you for listening. See you next time.